Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Hey, welcome to Investing Simplified. This is Chuck Price, President of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. And just to clarify something for all of our listeners, and if you're on the website, investingsimplifiedradio.com, any reference to the financial doctor, I am not a real doctor. So just in case any of you out there think that I am not a doctor. Or do I have a doctorate degree? But the financial doctor thing is just a little spoof on financial planning. And that's why we use a little cartoon character to make it kind of light and explainable. So if you have a question about that, pick up the phone, give me a call. I do want to mention that it still is on the website there. We're in the process of removing that that term because we want to make sure that nobody misunderstands that or is mistaken. Anyway, this is the show that is live where we answer your questions. Now, in studio with me via the phone is Carl Jepson. I see Carl's on the line. Carl, are you there?
I am here this morning, Chuck.
Well, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. My voice is improving. That's the most important part, I guess.
Well,
you're gonna do something on the radio.
You know, so. I got a message from Kevin, and he's got kind of the cold thing going. And I went through that for a couple of weeks, so I can certainly relate to that. But
I remember that. I got his email, and I was thinking that we all have that situation where we get the client that comes in and is just sicker than a dog and spreads it around, and then you end up with it. And it's just part of that procrastination thing, you know, don't wait to the last minute so that you can, you know, infect everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. We think you want to stay home and relax and get better. Listen, we're going to kick off the show. I'm going to give a quick, are you going to be able to hang in there for the show, Carl, or?
Just going to sit here and listen and do whatever I need to do. I do have a little bit of Carl's comment to play with if we need to.
So, okay. Well, we're gonna come right back to that. I was gonna give a quick stock report because I've gotten a lot of messages online about the stock market and the volatility of the market. I had a note when I came in here. Somebody said bonds and stocks seemed overpriced. Where do you suggest I invest right now? Well, let me tell you the story about what's really going on with the volatility because. I don't think you're hearing this on the news networks because they're too busy, you know, trying to get you to keep watching their shows so they make more money. But let's calm down. Cooler heads prevail. When things go bad, that's when you want to have a cool head. You don't want to make panic decisions without knowing all the facts. So let's kind of take a look at what's really going on in the stock market. 2018, as of 3/23, that would have been yesterday, Friday, the S&P closed down to 2,588.26. Now, Where is it at year to date? Well, year to date, it's down 3.3%. That's not anything to panic about. The Dow Jones closed at 23,533.20. It's down 5.04. Now, that's telling you that, you know, if you run that out for the year, that means over 12% on the S&P and over 20% on the Dow Jones, and that is what we would call a bear market. And that could be, but we're too early in the game to know. We're going to have a lot of volatility. There's a lot of uncertainty going on right now, but that doesn't mean you panic. And as I said a couple of weeks ago on the show, and as we've been telling our clients for years, if you have a strategy in your investment portfolio designed to level out the volatility, then right now you should not be worried about it. You should let your money manager or the person manage the portfolios, let them do their thing, because that's what they get paid to do. If they don't do it successfully, then you fire them. If they do it successfully, you say, wow, am I glad I had a strategy that worked. And that really is the name of the game, folks. I don't care what you're doing, whether you're building a house or you're investing your money or whatever you're doing. If you're paying somebody to do it and they're managing your money and they succeed at the end of the day, then you're happy. If they don't, then you're not going to be happy. And that's the way it ought to be. And But I'm going to say this, you don't panic at this point in time. This is not the time to be panicking. And if we go back and you look at the numbers of what we've done, you know, the S&P, if we go back to the turn of the century,
Stephen and Rebecca are extremely interesting. Don't believe me?
The S&P
check
is
out
up
their daily blogs at 4.42%
per year. So being down a little bit is really not a big thing when the portfolio is only done 4.42. And if you go back and you look at the NASDAQ, which is the tech stuff that should be the most volatile of all, it's only up 4.17% since 12/31/99. And if you look at the Dow Jones, not much better situation. The Dow Jones, back to 12/31/99, is up 6.32%. So it's way better than the other two. So is it any wonder why it's down 5 and the S&P's down 3? No, it might be a little overripe. You know, and we've had a pretty nice run up here the last year and a half. And so, look, whenever the market's going up, and really the markets have kind of went straight up since 2008, since the last major correction we had in the market, anybody in any real world is going to tell you we're going to have a little setback. You know, we're going to have a little pushback. And a pushback is not a bad thing if you have somebody controlling the ship. And if you don't, and you're controlling the ship, then, yeah, you could have some concerns. And the key thing to ask is, what did you do the last time we had a portfolio like this? What did you do in 2008? I was talking to somebody the other day, and they've done extremely well the last 3 years, but we went back and looked at their portfolio, what they did from 2008 to 2013, and they didn't make any money for 5 years. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm investing and I don't make any money for 5 years, I'm not going to be happy. I'm not going to be happy. So, you know, you want to look at the whole thing and take a long-term perspective and look at what you've done and where you're going, because let's face it, at the end of the day, we're all, with whatever we have, we're gonna live with that one way or the other. So, you can't go back and do-over like you can in golf. If you do a bad swing, get a do-over. But unfortunately, Carl, you and I know if we did do-overs every time we played golf, instead of 4 hours, we'd be there for 8 hours.
You're right. I was going to say I'd never get off the golf course.
Yeah. So sometimes you just got to say, you know what? I'm taking that shot, and I'm going with it because that's what I did.
Yep.
And you just play the game, and you just go through it, and you play the game. And that's kind of the game of life, too, folks. It really is. And so this is why I think it's very important that you have a strategy, and you stick to that strategy. And speaking of strategy, I'm gonna give you a free offer here. You're under no obligation to get this, but I have some books that I have available to you. If you want one, you call my office, stop by, pick it up. You don't have to have an appointment with me. The only thing I ask is that you actually read it. But I'm giving away some free books. I have a free book here about what you don't know may be hazardous to your wealth. Jeez, have I ever heard that before? Mutual Funds Exposed, second edition. This is why when you're going into retirement, you don't want to own mutual funds. If you don't know, and I've talked about it on the show a lot, you need to know. I also have copies of my book, Investing Simplified, What You Don't Know Can Hurt You. And it's available. I'll give you a free copy, no obligation, if you'll read it. If you read it. I've got my brand new book, which is a bestseller on Kindle. And it actually is a best-selling book. I did it with three other advisors and a guy who does our computer software for our retirement planning. It's called Your Retirement Made Simple. I'll give you a free copy. You don't have to buy it. I'll just give it to you. But all I ask is that you read it. Then I've got one more book that anybody who is 10 years out from retirement or anybody who is retired is looking at your retirement accounts. I've got a book by my good friend David Royer. It's called The Top 10 IRA Mistakes, How to Avoid the IRA Tax Traps. And I'm going to tell you this. The earlier you start, if you can start 10 or 15 years before you retire, if you wait to 5, you're too late. I mean, you still can do some planning, but the best planning you can do is done 10 to 15 years before you retire. And I really mean that. You've got to, if you want to do some real strategic planning, you want to do that 10 to 15 years out. And it's a book called Top 10 IRA Mistakes, How to Avoid IRA Tax Traps. And I do a little thing here in the book, on the back of the book. We actually sponsor this book and give it away. I think anybody who is looking at retirement, really serious about planning their retirement, should have a copy of this book. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Carl's comments. So you're listening to Investing Simplified. And listen, if you've got a question, this is the one show in Portland that is live. We actually answer your questions on the air. Give us a call at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. We'll be right back with Carl's comments.
We do Investing Simplified.
Hello, my name is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and co-host of the long-running radio talk show, Investing Simplified. My law practice emphasizes estate planning and probate. My mission statement is practical estate planning for peace of mind. This means that I listen carefully to my clients. I explain the various estate planning techniques and documents in the most understandable terms that I can. I try to make sure that my clients are comfortable with what we are doing together before proceeding, and I discuss my fees up front so that clients don't get any unwanted surprise. Estate planning and probate don't have to be that complicated. My experienced staff and I work closely with our clients to guide them through both of these matters in the simplest and most efficient manner possible. My office is located in the White Office Building at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, right across the street from Mall 205. My telephone number is 971-229-0585, and my website is carljepsenlaw.com.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepsen.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. And I'm here today, sitting at home. I have a little bit of a sore throat, so forgive my voice. But I thought it might be fun today just to talk about estate planning. I know that's a novel sort of idea. And anyway, Chuck, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can. I'm kind of an odd connection. So anyway, so I'd like to kind of go back and do some basics. One of the things we've talked about many, many times, and this comes up every week, but it's one I want to emphasize, and that is procrastination. One of the problems we have with estate planning is, at some point, most of us, I'm hoping not me, but most of us, end up being a little bit incapacitated, sometimes a lot incapacitated, to the point where we're not legally capable of making estate plans. And I'm telling you, that's not a good thing to do and wait for. You know, if you begin to think that you're getting a little, you know, you're losing a step here and there, you don't have to be losing your marbles to want to do estate planning. In fact, quite the contrary, when you do it as sharply as you can, the better it works. And that is, just take the guess that maybe it'll happen to you, and then take that next step, go to your estate planning attorney, and plan for what you want in your estate plan. Then you don't have the last-minute rush. I get this all the time. I got one the other day that a person calls up and says, hey, my spouse is in a care facility now. The psychologist says that if you're going to do any estate planning, you got to do it now. I'm thinking, are you nuts? Are you going, what? He's in a care facility now, and you want me to go and do an estate plan for this person that is no longer doing very well? That's asking for a lawsuit. So don't do that. Do it when you're well. Do it when you're thinking clearly. So that's kind of my comment, I guess you might say. But about estate planning, I thought it might be useful. In fact, you'll remember some of these things because we used to do all these seminars. I thought I'd just do a summary of some of that seminar material because it's very relevant today. And that's, what is good estate planning anyway? And we always used to say that, you know, giving your property to those persons that you select in the manner that you select and as economically and conveniently as possible is essentially good estate planning. Now, that doesn't involve, you know, the incapacity part, but essentially that's what people want. That they want to get their property to the people that they want to get it to. Interestingly enough, though, one of the things they often forget is that if they don't do that, if they don't make the choices, then the property has three places to go: individuals that they didn't choose, and the government and charities. So you kind of, there are very few places that you ultimately could send your money or your property. So,
hey, Carl?
Yes.
Hey, speaking about sending your money, we have a caller that does have a question just for you. He has a question about trustee of Father's Live Trust, and it's Mark. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
I'm in Portland, Oregon. My father's in Shoreline, Washington. He's been deemed an incapacitated adult through the elder abuse. We had to go through the whole elder abuse. A woman bought his house. It's worth $600,000 for a dollar on a quitclaim deed, and it's a mess. My question is, it was in foreclosure. The guardian forgot to make some payments. There was confusion on to... Anyway, yesterday I just worked out $13,000 to get my dad's house out of foreclosure. My brother Neil is a trustee. My other brother's an alternate. They don't want anything to do with this. How do I get them off the trust, or is there a form I fill out to get him off the trust? They don't want to be on the trust anymore.
They are named as trustees or second, or like...
One is... myself, I'm the oldest. I'm the trustee, and my third brother is an alternate.
Okay. Well, without looking at the trust, I can't tell you for sure, but as a practical matter, almost all trusts provide that the trustee can resign at any time.
Okay.
And that leaves you, that leaves you holding the bag, though. So,
I know, but I also read on the internet that he is still a beneficiary.
Well, yeah, you could. That's true, and I'm not sure that you can get rid of him as a beneficiary at this point. I mean, and is that because if you're saving the house, it sounds like you've intervened well enough to protect the largest asset, I guess.
Correct.
So I guess I'm not sure I understand why he would want to get off as a beneficiary. I mean,
He probably doesn't. But what's going to happen is, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to form this or articulate this, that they pay me $50 an hour. If I can do that, I'm just going to write it up and have them sign it. Do I need that notarized or witnessed? I mean, I'm going to end up going up there and doing all the repairs.
Yeah, actually, what you should do. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of issues in all of that.
Tell me about it.
What you really need to do is you need to go into, I don't even know where Shoreline is exactly. Where is that?
It's 8 miles north of Seattle.
Oh.
Between Everett and Seattle.
Okay. You need to find somebody, and I don't know anybody off the top of my head, but if you wanted to call me on Monday at my office, I could try to figure out somebody. I'm a Washington lawyer, but I don't do anything in Seattle. That's too far for me. But anyway, but what you need to do is sit down with a lawyer, have them review the trust, tell them what you want to do, and have them really give you some guidance. But as a practical matter, as a general rule, you have to read the trust, and you got to, you know, I'm not saying go out and do this, but generally speaking, the trustee can reimburse themselves from the trust assets if they've been paying expenses on behalf of the trust that they had to, that were reasonable. Don't do that until you've talked to the lawyer, because I haven't seen this trust or anything, but that's kind of a general rule is how that works.
Now,
as far as doing stuff, you know, you're getting paid for your services as trustee, most trusts provide that you can be. And even if it doesn't have any provision, most of the trust laws say that you're at best, you're at worst, you're entitled to some kind of reasonable compensation. That gets to be a little bit dicey sometimes if you've got some of the beneficiaries think that you're, you know, taking advantage of the trust. But as a practical matter, you're entitled to reimbursement for expenses that are, you know, paid on behalf of the trust that are, you know, directly coming out of your pocket,
right,
as long as they're reasonable. And then secondly, you're also entitled generally to some kind of reasonable compensation.
Right.
But before you set that up, you want to talk to your lawyer, and I would say, yes, it is best to get an agreement that says, yes, trustee or beneficiaries, we agree that this is a reasonable amount. But right. I think I would do that. I would talk to the lawyer first, make sure that you have a good set of guidelines to work with. I usually try to send out a letter to my clients. It's a kind of an exhaustive list of duties that they have. Not that they have to do all of them, but I mean, because most trusts don't require all of them. But nonetheless, it gives them a kind of an outline of how they do that. And I'm sure that most of the lawyers in Seattle would be doing that too.
I appreciate your time.
Look for somebody who does probate, estate planning, trust administration, that kind of stuff.
All right. Thank you for your time.
You betcha.
Well, Carl, I think you started something here, because we got another caller on the line who's got a similar question. Kathy's got a question about personal representatives compensation. Are you there, Kathy?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My sister is a personal representative for our aunt's estate. My sister lives in Oregon. The aunt was from Washington. And she is wondering if she can get how much would be a reasonable expense for her time.
Well, that's a little bit more challenging with the personal representative than, say, for example, a trustee. What I would suggest, though, if it was in Oregon, Oregon has a provision that allows the personal representative to generally get a statutory compensation, which is based on a percentage of the size of the estate, depending on how big it is. And that's supposed to cover the whole thing, and usually it does. There's also a provision that allows the personal representative. Well, it's a sliding scale thing. It's really kind of a calculation. but anyway, say on an estate of around $500,000, you're probably talking about, I don't know, $10,000 fees, maybe something like that. That's just a rough guess. I could do it quickly for you, but my math isn't so good this morning on Saturday. But anyway, then what you can do also is that Oregon allows you to go to the court and say, hey, you know, this is an unusual thing.
I had to do a lot of extra. Washington State that the aunt died in. Washington.
I know, and that's why I was getting back to the next step, which is I can't remember exactly what the Washington statute says. And so if you wanted to give me a buzz at the office so that I could get on my computer and find out what it is, because I just haven't had a chance to, or maybe even later in the show, if I get a chance, I'll try to find out what the statutory fee structure is. But best that you could do it would be on Monday or something, and give me a holler at my office and find that out.
Yeah. The other expenses, such as, I mean, she has to be appointed by the court, so she'll be going to King County and having to go before the someone in the court to be appointed.
Yeah, all of that stuff is, yeah, they do, but she doesn't. The likelihood that she'll have to go to court at all is very slim. Usually it's a complete paper process. And what happens is the lawyer has to do it all, basically. I'll tell you that Washington's probate process is pretty easy for the most part, unless you've got people fighting with each other. But if it's just kind of a normal probate, it's relatively easy. But knowing what the papers look like and when they're supposed to get there and who's supposed to get them is not quite so easy. That's really a lawyer's job. And what happens is the lawyer gets paid out of the estate funds, and and so does the personal representative. So they get paid first, and then whatever's left gets dispersed to the beneficiaries after they paid creditors and things, if there are any. So she will get reimbursed for expenses that she paid, presuming that there's there are assets to cover it. But she'll have work to do if she's got to sell a home or something like that. There's stuff that has to be done. So there's definitely work to being a personal representative.
Oh yeah, she's already doing a lot of it, but the attorney says she has to go and be present to be appointed.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure about that one. I've never seen that. I've never had that issue. The ones that I've done in Washington, we just did it by paperwork, just like we do here in Oregon. So I'll defer to my more experienced counsel in King County, I guess. So maybe it's an individual court thing. Sometimes different circuit courts have different rules. I know that, like here, Multnomah County is quite a bit different than say Washington County, and so it could very well be that there's a special requirement.
And what you said about all of the expenses, the personal representative, and all of the bills and everything else before the rest of the beneficiaries, the money is divvied up with them.
Usually the personal representative gets reimbursed from the estate for those things.
You had just said that they would be paid first, and I assume that all of the outstanding bills would be paid first, and then percentages for the beneficiaries come after everything is paid.
Well, yeah, the beneficiaries get whatever's left, and depending on what the will says, if there's a will that says, you know, have to or equally, then they divide.
Yes, it says percentages.
Yeah, well, then they take whatever's left.
And if she has a letter of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
That contradicts it, and it can't be used because the will.
I know the letter of instruction basically said, and that's because the case isn't over. You really need. Generally, you want the approval of the court. There may be some that you could do without the approval, but generally, you want the approval of the court before you reimburse those costs. And that's the whole point of going through the court process, so that it's orderly and you don't have, not that your sister would, but you know, that you don't have somebody who's just kind of, you know, using it like their own expense account, which, right. You know, sometimes happens. But nonetheless, because if she hasn't been appointed, technically she doesn't really have legal authority to do anything.
That's
so,
right, and she hasn't been appointed, but there are bills coming in, and the lawyer says you have to come in and be appointed, and don't spend one penny without opening an estate checking account.
Well, and I think that's wise as a general rule.
Right.
Now, sometimes the timing of it doesn't work, and you know,
she has to file her personal tax return.
Well, she's going to have to do that, but she can get an extension.
Yeah, but you have to pay money.
Well,
you have
right,
to pay money on an extension, don't you?
It's like saying when you've got to pay the utility bill, but and it doesn't take very long to be appointed, so she needs to go do it right away, and then she'll have the authority to do what she needs to do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet.
Okay.
Hey, Carl, just a little follow-up to that. We had a caller leave a message, and Alan had a question about deceased people on a deed, what to do.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
Well, evidently they had some people who whose, let's say his mom and dad was on the title of their property, and they'd passed away.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I could tell a very long story, but I won't. but, okay, well, it depends, first of all, what is on the deed. Some deeds provide a survivorship mechanism. In other words, they say that it's John and Jim and Jack, with survivorship, which would mean if one of them died, Jim dies, so John and Jack automatically own the property. That isn't real customary in Oregon or Washington generally, but you can have it. If it's just their names, the people on the deed, then those persons each have an equal interest unless there are some other, amount of interest indicated. And you have to probate the estate to distribute the property. I mean, there's no way about it. If the property is worth less than $200,000, they might be able to get by with a small estate, but title companies are a little nervous about that when they're splitting the interest. And quite frankly, there's almost no real property under $200,000 left in Oregon, or not in Portland anyway.
That's for sure.
Yeah, so they're going to have to do an estate, and they need to go to the lawyer, and then they probate the estate, and the personal representative distributes the property. Now, if those people are dead, are deceased, there again, that's an interesting issue, but more often than not, what you're going to have to do is find out, did they have a will? Did they have a probate when they died? Did they have a trust? Probably not, but did they, and did they have any heirs? And that could get really tricky. Once upon a time, we had a case that involved 32 heirs and no will. And you may remember this because there were I don't know how many brokerage houses had
yes,
stock.
I do.
And we ultimately got you guys to sort out all of the stock, but I had this big chart in my office that one of those family tree kind of looking things that we found all these different relatives. We had hired private detectives and all sorts of stuff because what we ended up with, this guy had all this money. It was well over, I think, $1 million or $2 million, and this was back in the day when that was a really lot of money. And what we did was this fellow had no will, he had no children, he had no brothers, he had no sisters. I mean, it was like, it was like everybody was dead except, cousins twice removed. And we found 32 of these folks. We had one guy that had, the way we got got to find him was an investigator found him living in a trailer court in Coos Bay on Highway 101. Guy didn't even have a phone, so the guy comes out to the payphone on Highway 101, and I got to call him on the phone and say, "Hey, I'm going to give you $30,000. What do you think?" I mean, it was kind of cool. But remember, it was like The Millionaire. Remember that show?
Yep, absolutely.
Anyway, so that's a good example of not good bad estate planning or no estate planning, and how it can get confusing. So yeah, but to answer that question, he's got to go do a probate of some sort.
Okay, well, hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come right back. Carl, stay on the line in case we get another. We've had a lot of calls for you, so stay on the line, and okay. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Wealth Management. Price Financial Group. Wealth Management.
Hello, this This is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question answered now. Call Chuck or Carl at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Chuck Price and Carl Jepsen.
Hey, welcome back to Investing Simplified. Carl, since you're on the phone there, did you have a little bit that you wanted to finish up on your Carl's comments?
Well, I could. I'll do it really shortly, I guess. The questions really answered a lot of it. So we just talked a lot about, I'll just go on as we talked about how that property goes to various people when you die. And that's the number one thing people want to know about. So there are a couple ways. One, make them devisees in a will. In other words, they have to probate the will, and the will says, give it to my uncle or give it to my son or give it to my children. That's a devisee. Those are devisees. That's one way. The other way is intestate succession, which is no will, which is kind of no planning, and it gives them to those people that the law says are the next in line, but they may not be the people that you want them to go to, so you want to kind of avoid that unless you like it that way. The other way is to have a property that's jointly held, so that or survivorship property, so that it goes automatically on death. The other kind is to have property that's in a living trust, which avoids the probate and allows them to distribute the property immediately, more or less, after the death, and does so without any kind of fol-de-rol or courts or stuff, so long as everything is done carefully in the beginning. And I think that's about it. So is that fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's great. And we've got a caller there. Looks like it's going to be asking here a question for a minute. So I'm going to kind of give a little tease here, because after we get this caller, if we don't, then I'm going to go through a little diatribe here on annuities, because everybody has questions about annuities. And usually annuities cause real anxiety either one way or the other. People say, oh, I hate those, or, well, I don't really know about them, so how do they work? And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the history of them and to kind of give you a little broader perspective than probably you've ever heard about them. But right now, Carl, we've got Lynn's on the phone with a question about her father's estate passing away in the middle of a trust. So, Lynn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and your question is?
Well, my father passed away, and my brother and my father were in the middle of putting his trust together. And when they unearthed his will, somebody had written some things into that will, handwritten, and my father kind of shook his head at it, so then he passed away. So now we have an estate that was not fully done in the trust and a will that's been written on. So I'm wondering how that distribution, what happens, and he is remarried.
Oh, man, this is a law school examination.
It's a mess.
I'm not even going to hazard a guess at that one. Here's what I would do, though. The first thing I would do would be I would want to get all of the documents you have, everything, and then take a look and see if we can figure out what we have, and then figure out, you know, obviously we have some certainty in this thing, it sounds like. And one of the things that is new, Oregon just passed some new laws as far as their probate and stuff like that. And, hello?
Yes, I'm here.
So, Okay. Anyway, there's some new laws that make it somewhat easier to prove what the testator intended, even if somebody kind of made notes and stuff like that.
Okay.
But it still means that what we need to do is do our best possible analysis at it, and then depending on the situation. Let's suppose we've got perhaps an argument with between some of the beneficiaries or whoever they think they might be beneficiaries. Theoretically, we could do a number of things, but one of the things we could always do is actually file a motion with a court, go to the court, and say, "Hey, court, here's what we got. We need you to decide what this means."
Okay.
That way, you kind of, when you do it that way, you avoid the argument that the benefit or that the personal representative or the trustee or whoever's doing the stuff is trying to squeeze the other guys.
It's interesting because his wife is the executor, and she has children. And so one of the children was written in. This is the written in part of my father's will.
Children right prior marriage, is that the deal?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. That adds another wrinkle to it. I mean, this has got like issue after issue layered on top of itself. So
yeah,
it's interesting. It's good that you thought to call.
So normally, if that was to happen and we didn't have all the extras, but, my father passed away, I'm assuming they're probably going to void his will because it's been written on. What do they do with that? Do they just split it down the middle? I have three other siblings.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're going to void the will. That's what I'm saying. Just because you wrote on it doesn't necessarily mean you made it. You avoided it.
We don't know if it was my father that wrote on it.
Oh well, then see there we go. We got some issues. And there again, and he remarried because the remarriage would generally do away with any distributions that he had in a prior estate plan that went to the former spouse. But it's nothing that says that he couldn't do a will or a trust that would give something to children by prior marriage. He could do that.
Right.
If there was no will, then you'd have a kind of a little. Then you'd have an intestate succession thing, and that would, just depending on who remains alive, would determine who gets what.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll keep working at our mess.
if you don't have a lawyer, you really need somebody to sort this out, really. It's going to make you crazy.
I think my brother has figured out who we're going to go talk to.
Good.
But I just wondered if maybe you might send us in a different direction or something.
No. You're going in the right direction. Get in there and have them figure it out.
Okay.
Let us know when you find out, let us know how it turns out.
Okay, I will.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Good call. We've got another caller on the line. Hal's got a question about traditional IRA or Roth.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know if you need to know my age or if, have...
Well, are you trying to decide whether to do a traditional or a Roth?
Well, I've been investing for 20 years, and so I'm middle-aged, and I've always just had a hard time not taking the tax deduction of the traditional, even though I'm just a humble wage earner. And I don't think I'm going to have a huge estate, but I don't know if I should try to look at the tax brackets and estimate my... when I'm going to retire in about 10 years. And plus, then I only have like 10 more years to invest, so should I try to diversify and go into some Roth now?
Here's what I always recommend. And, what tax bracket are you in? Are you in a high tax bracket?
I believe the lowest federal. Not the lowest, I pay decent taxes, but I'd say the normal low one.
And are you in Oregon?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yep, I'm in Oregon.
Okay, so
I'm a wage earner.
Okay, so you're paying another 8 or 9% on top of the federal.
Well, yes, I'm well aware of that. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Great state of.
Well, here's what I recommend. Unless you've got a really good pension plan, retirement plan, I recommend you take the deductions as long as you can. And if you're in probably a 25% or higher bracket, I would definitely take the deduction, max out your retirement. Then if you have any savings left, then put some money in a Roth.
Okay.
But take your max.
Yeah, because being over 50 and the 401k for my humble salary, I mean, you go pretty crazy going like 24,000 or so into the deductible 401k. So yeah, that probably wouldn't leave money left to go in my particular case. But yeah, I appreciate that advice. Is that what you mean?
I'd take the max right off. You could, you know, because you still got to live. You know, you're exactly right. I mean, if you could bury 10 or 12,
pass it up. Even. Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. And hey, real quick, I think that's really nice gesture about you having those books available. I'm gonna call your office and because I'm in that 10-year to retire window.
Yeah,
if I get everything done right. So yeah,
and you swing by and pick up a copy, and we'll be glad to give you a copy.
Awesome. All right. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you. Thanks for calling. Well, Carl, I'm going to get into this subject here real quick about a little bit about the history about annuities, so people have a little broader perspective. Because I hear people on the radio talking about these things, but I kind of want to clear the air on them. Back when I got started in the business, back, you know, about when the ARC was being built, the only thing we had was fixed annuities from the insurance company, where the insurance company offered an interest rate, and you could put your money in the annuity, and that money would grow tax deferred, and then you could pull it out. But normally, the insurance company set the rate. Then a few years later, the securities industry said, hey, you know what? These insurance agents are making a lot of money selling annuities. We need to offer one that has some securities in it so we can kind of beef up the return, was the theory. Doesn't always work. But they came out with what's called the variable annuity. The major difference between the two is the one that the insurance company sets the interest rate, there is no fees or charges. The variable annuity, there are high internal charges, and generally speaking, variable annuities are going to run anywhere from 1 to 4% internal costs. And so if you're at the high end of that, it's very, very tough. And then somebody came up with the idea that, you know what, why don't we start charging an additional 95 basis points to 1.5 basis points, and put an income rider on that variable annuity, which that really jacked up a lot of variable annuities to a very high internal cost, in somewhere around the 4 to 5% area. And so those become very, very costly. Then somebody in the insurance industry said, you know, hey, these guys selling variable annuities and talking about these high market returns, we need to figure out how we can take a fixed annuity, put it in an index, call it a equity indexed annuity is what they originally were called. And then when the SEC started looking at them and saying, hey, that's a security, they quickly changed the name to fixed indexed annuity. And the fixed indexed annuity, they wanted to keep it out of being a security, and that is why you have guys out there pushing fixed index annuities that are not securities licensed or securities trained, selling that product as a fixed product. But here's the thing I would say, and anybody offering you an annuity, our office is a fiduciary, and I've heard that expressed a lot of different ways on TV. And so I want to clarify here, a fiduciary means that we put our clients first. And what we did in our office as a fiduciary office is we don't get compensated any more on an annuity than we do on an investment portfolio. We get compensated the same. And I could tell you that isn't the case with most guys that call themselves a fiduciary. They generally make 7 to 10 times more selling you the annuity product they're selling versus what they get on the fee base. That's why you hear a lot of these guys on the radio talking about income, income, income. Well, income, income, income is important, but I would rather have the cash. To me, cash is king. I'd rather have the money. I'd rather have my money earning money, paying out less fees so that it's my retirement plan, not the agent's retirement plan. So if somebody's recommending an annuity to you, here's some questions you need to ask the agent. Number one, what is your compensation on this annuity? And he's going to come back and say, well, you don't pay a commission. The insurance company pays me. Okay, but how much does the insurance company pay you? What's your incentive to sell this annuity to me? I get the same compensation on an annuity as I do on a fee-based investment portfolio. We have no incentive, financial incentive. And I could tell you there are guys that have major overhead, and the way they get their overhead paid is they get a very high compensation, sometimes 7 to 10 times what we would get on selling you this product. To me, you should not be compensated any more on the annuity than you should on an investment product. And if your advisor isn't doing that, then you need to come see me and I'll show you the difference. The other thing is, what you don't know can hurt you. And what you should be asking is, this annuity that you're putting me in, does it have a cap or does it have a spread? And let me explain to you the difference. I had a company call me the other day. They wanted me to sell their product. And I listened to it, but the product only had caps, which means if the market did really well, my clients could make a max of 6%. Okay, well, 6%. Sometimes right now, 6% looks pretty darn good, okay, because the markets are down. But, you know, that was the max. We have other companies that have a spread where the insurance company keeps the first 1 or 2 or 3%, then the client gets 97% of the growth. I like that a lot better than being capped at 6%. If the market made 10 and your client ends up getting 8, that's much better than 6. But the insurance company likes that cap because if the market did 10 and they only got to pay out 6, they made 4. Because they got to make up for that big difference they're paying the agent that sold you the case. So why is it important for you to ask somebody that? Because look, no matter where you go, if you go to a medical doctor and you have medical insurance, do you really think the medical doctor sees you for free? He doesn't. He's going to bill the insurance company, and if you're on Medicare, they're going to bill Medicare. Now, you're going to pay a deductible, but you know in the back of your mind that doctor's also getting paid from Medicare, or he's paid from the insurance company. So, listen, be an astute investor. Ask the questions. What are my fees? What are the costs of this? How long are my funds tied up? And what's in it for you? What's your compensation? How much do you get? And is this my retirement plan or is it your retirement plan? And that's a legitimate question you ought to be asking. Carl, how's somebody get a hold of you if they need to?
Well, they can reach me at 971-229-0585, or they can contact us at the web at carljepsonlaw.com.
Well, and I wanted to mention that Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm is usually with us, but he is busy trying to recuperate, and he's burning the midnight oil doing income taxes. And I'm glad that he is because he's my CPA and he did mine too, so I'm happy that he's burning the midnight oil getting things done. Kevin is located with Baker Colson Professional Corporation. You can reach him at 503 866-5569. You can reach me at pfgwm.com, 503-253-3000, or toll-free 877-50-PRICE. God bless you all. And if you haven't seen the movie, I can only imagine, I recommend you go see it. I saw it Tuesday. It's one of the best movies I've seen. Dennis Quaid ought to get an Academy Award. It is a great movie. Go see it, and God bless you all.
Bryce Financial Group.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news. Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called AssetLock. AssetLock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers AssetLock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have AssetLock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get AssetLock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Simplify.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000.